Tested is sponsored by Duke Health, home of the Pandemic Response Network, helping communities stay safe and connected during the COVID-19 pandemic by partnering with local school, business, and faith-based organizations to launch COVID-19 symptom support programs in their own communities. Learn more at pandemicresponsenetwork.org. We're also supported by Hungry Harvest, delivering farm-fresh produce and kitchen staples to your door starting at $15. Every delivery fights food waste and supports local hunger-solving organizations. HungryHarvest.net.
I'm Dave DeWitt. This is Tested from WUNC, a look at what today's challenges tell us about where we are, what we believe, and who we want to be in North Carolina and the South. Today, a year we will never forget. Where were you a year ago? Maybe you know generally what your mindset was as the reality of the pandemic began to set in. I remember where I was on March 10th, 2020, anxiously watching a press conference.
Governor Roy Cooper is briefing reporters at this hour and is expected to declare a state of emergency in response to more confirmed cases of the coronavirus in North Carolina. The declaration allows resources...
1 year later, nearly 900,000 North Carolinians have officially contracted COVID, with the number likely much higher. And over 11,000 people, parents, sons, daughters, cousins, colleagues, and friends have died. As we arrive at this signpost, it seems like a good time to look back at the road we've come down.
I am Will Michaels. I am the General Assignment Reporter at WUNC.
General Assignment Reporter is one of those titles that means today you're covering whatever the most important news story is. And for the past year, that has meant, on most every day, COVID. So Will seems like exactly the right person to talk to about what we knew and didn't know a year ago, and how the pandemic has dominated every day of our lives since. So Will, what sort of stands out to you when you look back at the state's initial response? And I'm talking back in March of 2020.
Well, looking back at some of those first briefings, including that one that we just heard about, first thing that stands out to me is no one is social distancing. No one has a mask on. There are reporters in the room, which if you keep track of the briefings these days, reporters are joining by phone. There are a limited number of people in the Emergency Operations Center every time the governor has a press briefing. They, at that point, were just starting to give guidance about keeping, you know, surfaces clean, which as we now know today, is less important than maybe wearing a mask and keeping yourself and others protected that way. We just clearly didn't know much about the virus at that point. And Governor Roy Cooper, actually, in that same briefing, said that he planned to go to the ACC tournament, which was canceled a few days later. And in that same briefing, you know, the one thing that really stood out to me was one reporter asks, the chief of staff of the Emergency Operations Center says, we're going to be in emergency mode as long as this event is going on. And one reporter asks, well, how long is that going to be?
I heard the chief of staff say that you're going to remain in emergency mode throughout this event. Do you have even a guess as to how long that's going to be?
I'm going to let Dr. Cohen maybe give a response to that.
We are planning for this to be an extended posture, which is different than a hurricane kind of posture. So we're all going to have to be sensitive about the fact that this is a marathon.
So it could be months.
It could be months.
That one really hit me in the gut because, of course, now here we are a year later.
Yeah, it's hard to overstate, thinking back to then, how little everyone knew. Experts, obviously the media, anybody, and sort of what that meant for people out there in the world trying to figure out what was going on, but also how they should act and how they should react. And one of the things I remember were these COVID-19 infection models. And when you review those back from March, April, how accurate were they?
They were good guesses based on what we knew, which, as you just said, was not much. And if you remember, too, we were also really obsessed with the peak, right? There was all this talk about we need to flatten the curve, of course, of the number of new cases on a daily basis. And the early models, one from the University of Washington, which got a ton of attention early on, was talking about, you know, a peak being somewhere in the spring, April, then it was eventually pushed back to May, then it was eventually pushed back to June. And at some point, we just figured, okay, there's probably not going to be a peak. There are going to be multiple peaks. And of course, we're used to that now. But looking back at the time, here's what was happening. Dr. Fauci was saying that he was expecting between 100,000 and 200,000 deaths in the United States. Of course, we've surpassed 500,000 now. There was a team put together from Duke and UNC and RTI looking at, you know, how quickly could hospitals become overwhelmed. We actually had Aaron McKeithen, a Duke health policy professor, on Tested in April of 2020. I remember him likening these models to a forecast for a hurricane, which he said was something that, you know, North Carolinians could relate to. So he described it that way. And of course, there are differences between a hurricane and the pandemic.
But what's different here, of course, the reason that metaphor breaks down very quickly is that we actually can influence the path and intensity of the storm, unlike a hurricane. So I think on the other side of the peak, however it's measured, whether it's through cases or through the rates of hospitalizations, a lot depends on how society responds and what the policies are once we get beyond the peak.
And the argument can be made that that's where we are now, beyond the peak, right? We've seen a spike in cases over the winter, and of course we could have another one, but we've saw a spike in cases over the winter. The number of new cases is down, and the question becomes, what do we do now? Do we follow Texas's lead and get rid of the mask mandate? Do we keep these things in place? There's a lot of talk about getting school districts back into in-person learning. The governor is pushing for that. State Board of Education is now pushing for that. And a lot of districts are providing that option. So, we're not out of it. And I know that y'all have talked about that many times on this program, but we're not out of it yet. And that was one thing that sort of struck me, that early on, while these models didn't know much, there was at least this thought that what really matters is what we do afterwards.
And so we all sort of have lived through this, and we all have kind of these little memories or these defining moments that we'll remember. And as a reporter, you were very focused on covering the sort of daily news of this changed, or this stat, or this number. And so some of that, having done that a little bit myself back in the day, it can run together somewhat. But also then there probably are some moments I'm thinking that you look back on and go, oh, that I'll remember. That's a defining moment in the last year. What are some of those for you?
Yeah, there are a lot, but one has to be the killing of George Floyd. As soon as that happened, in the following days, when demonstrations took off across the country, we were covering the ones happening in North Carolina. I specifically was covering the ones happening in Durham. And it was this like really poignant, so many poignant moments happening in interviews that I did during those protests that kept pointing to this idea that, you know, yeah, we are in the midst of a pandemic, but, this is this is a racial reckoning that has been a long time coming. And it is, as Breonna Baker put it, on Tested, actually, back in June of 2020. She's a public health analyst for RTI International, talked about why she decided to protest in Raleigh.
America has made clear that COVID-19 and being Black in this country can both cost you your life. And frankly, I'd rather lose my last breath fighting for overdue justice for my community. So I think that summarizes the significance of these demonstrations amidst a global pandemic. Justice for Black lives transcends any physical or systemic weapon formed against us.
And that was something that y'all reported on, but there are dozens of comments that I've heard very similar from protesters in Durham, some of whom said, you know, am I next? Some people of color who go out into the street and protest and say, am I next? COVID has been killing us. Police have been killing us. And it's time for change.
You know, I'll also think back to, you know, there were real heroes, you know, not just doctors and nurses and people on the front lines working, you know, obviously saving lives and saving so many lives. But the work that happened here in the Triangle, in the laboratories at UNC Chapel Hill and at Duke, you know, helping develop the vaccines or the treatments that are, you know, going to be globally and are globally being asserted across the world and have saved who knows how many people's lives and are continuing to. We're sitting here now a year later with three vaccines that are being distributed across, you know, the United States, at least, and in other countries. A lot of them have roots to this area, but logistics have sort of gotten in the way of getting that out maybe as quickly as we'd want to. How is North Carolina's rollout going as we're sitting here today?
Well, as you're saying that, quick shout out to Dr. Kazmekia Corbett, UNC UNC School of Medicine alum. She's actually going to be speaking at UNC's commencement this spring. She helped develop the Moderna COVID-19 vaccine. The rollout is, you know, it's going well in some ways and not going as quickly or well in other ways. What's, I think, been good about this is that early on, North Carolina was not getting the vaccine out very quickly. Actually, we were close to last in how quickly we were getting out the vaccine. That quickly changed, and over a few weeks in January, we started using up all of the first doses that we were getting from the federal government every single week. Now, the flip side to that is that getting the vaccine out quickly does not mean that the vaccine has gotten out equitably. There is still a big racial discrepancy in who's getting the vaccine. I think about close to just a little under 20% of people who have gotten the first dose are Black or Hispanic, but those groups make up 31% of the state population. The good news, I suppose, is that the state does seem to be aware of this and is putting out equity doses to each of the local providers in an attempt to remedy that. And that number, to their credit, has gotten better, but it's still clearly there's a gap there. Now that we have a third vaccine, the Johnson & Johnson vaccine, clearly the state thinks that it can get the vaccine out even more quickly. We've moved on to group three, which includes an estimated 1.2 million people statewide. All of a sudden, you know, we had gone from addressing tens of thousands of people at once to hundreds of thousands to now just adding more than a million people into eligibility. I'm not exactly sure what the strategy is there. I've tried to sort of glean that from the state health department to say, you know, what makes you so sure that we can keep getting this vaccine out when all of a sudden more than a million people just became eligible? Yes, you're saying that you're getting more doses, but not that much more. So I'm not exactly sure how well it's going to keep going, but we are around the middle of the pack nationwide when it comes to the percentage of the population that has been vaccinated.
Yeah, it's so interesting to look back and know that, you know, North Carolina's strategy early was to get vaccines into all 100 counties. So thinking regionally equitable, but it isn't, as you stated, sort of racially equitable by any means. So much of how we have viewed the pandemic has been both broadly, you and I reporting on it, and also anecdotally. Like, I know somebody very close to me who, you know, was in that 1 million group, right? And called, stayed on the line for however long, and then finally got an appointment and was shocked to learn and asked the question, do you want the Moderna? Do you want the Pfizer? Do you want the Johnson & Johnson? It's like an a la carte. And
I didn't even know it was a choice.
Yeah, and it apparently is a choice for some people who call in and make an appointment. So we're in a different stage where vaccines are going to become much more available, and it's kind of just vaccinate as many people as you can. It seems like it's hard to know what the strategy is, if there even is one at this point. Looking back at this year, looking at it from sort of that anecdotal and also as a reporter, how has this changed how you've done your job as a reporter?
Yeah, I mean, there are the obvious things like working from home. I remember that week, that same week that we talked about that first briefing back in March 10th of 2020, that same week we started working from home. And I remember getting an email from management saying, we're going to start working from home. We think that we'll be back in 3 weeks. that's our goal right now. We will reevaluate what the virus is doing in 3 weeks and figure out if we can come back. It's a year later. You and I mean, I've seen you on Zoom just about every day, but I actually haven't seen you in person for a year. And so, I mean, there are those clear, I mean, you know, and all the technical glitches that come with working from home too. But it's also the uprisings, the demonstrations after George Floyd's killing, coupled with the pandemic and this sort of long haul that it's been, it has been a reminder to, for me anyway, to go back to some of the basics of journalism, listen to people who are actually being affected by this. And, you know, sometimes I think our knee-jerk reaction is to analyze a lot of stuff. That's what we've been doing for this entire conversation, right? But to actually talk to people who this is affecting, listen to them, and understand that what they're going through is not just what you hear in the headlines of unemployment, losing your job and, you know, losing income or not being able to pay your mortgage or something like that. But it has to do with family members being infected by COVID, what that does to someone's mental health, what being in isolation does to someone's mental health. Those are real things that we've all heard from people throughout this year. And those have been, I guess, the saddest, but also the most meaningful things that we've heard during this pandemic to me.
Will Michaels is a general assignment reporter at WUNC. More after a break.
Pauli Murray was a brave Black Southern woman who always held people's feet to the fire. She encountered a sinister combination of racism and sexism throughout her life, but Pauli never took any of it lying down. She worked tirelessly as an activist, a lawyer, and a priest to fight for human rights. Check out Pauli, a new podcast about the power of one person to change what's possible for us all. Download and listen wherever you get your podcast.
We've spent a good portion of this podcast critiquing and discussing what our elected leaders and health professionals said and did during the pandemic. So it seems only fair now to turn the microscope on our profession. It's always fraught when we lump the media all together and analyze how they did. But the Fourth Estate played an enormous role in passing along good and sometimes bad information during this pandemic. The vast majority of journalists really have tried to honestly and accurately make sense of the science and the social and economic realities that were in upheaval for the past year. Last week, I spoke with Dr. Lisa Gerlinski, a true hero who has worked ungodly hours in the lab under enormous pressure. As one of the world's few coronavirus experts at the beginning of this pandemic, she's also been interviewed more than she probably ever thought she'd be. She also consumes a lot of news, so I asked her, how has the media done?
By and large, the media has done a pretty good job. You know, we were all caught off guard at this time last year and, you know, 13, 14 months ago when it was first coming out, because we had never seen a highly transmissible, highly pathogenic coronavirus before. We had never seen a coronavirus that transmitted pre-symptomatically and asymptomatically. So, you know, based on what we had known previously, some of that early advice was off, but we have owned that and moved on. And so that was you know, messaging that came from many sources, including myself, because, you know, going through the literature, listening to what Dr. Fauci had to say, I was like, okay, well, you know, we probably don't need to worry about asymptomatic transmission because we've never seen it before. Well, new virus, new situation. The one caution that I do have right now is people are going crazy about variants. There's been a lot of fuss in the scientific community about people with data that is maybe okay, maybe completely sketchy, you know, contacting the press before they release the data for other scientists to see before it's submitted to a preprint, definitely before it's submitted for publication somewhere. And, you know, being asked to comment on things when I haven't seen the data is impossible. So we need to not blow things up too much, even though some of these variants do seem to be an issue. You know, they do transmit a little bit better. The South Africa variant does seem to be more difficult to neutralize with, you know, the current antibodies and vaccines, but it's not a catastrophe. We're going to be okay. We'll get there. It might be a little bit more work for sure. But just because a couple of things have been concerning doesn't mean every new mutation is time to panic.
That's it for this episode of Tested. I'm Dave DeWitt. Rebecca Martinez produced this episode. Amanda Magnus was the editor. Lindsay Foster Thomas is the executive producer. Thanks for listening.